So yeah, we talked about the concept of leisure and some of our cultural, how would you say, some of our cultural inclinations that resist such. So this morning, I want to talk about the source. You know, maybe it strikes you somewhat odd that we're talking about leisure at church. But I want us to talk about the source of leisure. Where do you think the idea of leisure came from? Yeah, God and the Sabbath. Good, good, good. So leisure is indeed God's idea. And in fact, at a certain point in the Bible, you'll see that he explicitly commands it. You know, he forces us, forces it upon us, if you will, which shows a couple things about us and him all at the same time. Leisure is not only God's idea, we talked about last week a little bit, it's the very goal of life. Why do I say that? Why would I say leisure is the goal? What's that? Yes. Correct. And so how is it the goal? Go for it. What? Heaven, yes. And you know, and it is heaven. What do we think of when we think of heaven? I mean, the end of our days, according to Scripture, you know, historically speaking, the church has spoken of heaven in a lot of different ways, but one of the ways that they encapsulate the experience of heaven is the beholding of God, right? The beatific vision. That kind of, and some of the way that the beatific vision can be expressed, depending on what tradition you come from, can very much sound like it was written by one of the philosophers themselves. But it is this kind of act of eternal contemplation or embracing or the idea of, you know, beholding God and enjoying and delighting in the beauty and the being of our Maker. But we will be, according to even what we confess, enjoying God forever, right? I've heard that somewhere before. I don't quite remember where. And in that way, when we enter into the heavenly rest, there's nothing to gain, right? There's nothing to prove. There's nothing, in one sense, to accomplish, not in the way that we look at accomplishments, right? There's nothing that we're trying to climb in order to achieve. Our job or our duty, as C.S. Lewis says, will be delight. I mean, and it will be to delight in God himself. Historically, then, if you look, leisure has found not only its basis, but its greatest defense in religion. You know, it's the church or the cult. You know, if you look in Judaism and then what becomes what we call Christianity, these have been the great defenders and those who feel that they have a basis for the concept of leisure. When we speak of things like holiday, what are we saying? This is those words that get lost, you know. Like a bridal shower. What's a bridal shower? Yeah. See, it's when the bride takes a shower. No, hopefully she's done that once or twice before then. But it's a bride ale party, right? And so we call it a bridal party or a bridal shower. But it really was a time where, you know, the bride and her friends got together and drank ale, strangely enough. But that gets lost, right? It becomes a word that, well, holiday is the same. What is holiday? It's a holy day, right? But, you know, or it's in England, it's when you go on vacation. sounds so much better on holiday, doesn't it? it is a holy day. And again, the idea, therefore, if you notice the progression of things, you know, our idea of holiday comes from the source of religions that were keeping holy days. And when you were keeping holy days, especially in cultures without a deep concept of Sabbath, that was the only time that would happen. What would happen on those days? You didn't have to work. You know, you could actually enjoy, you could rest, you could have some delight in the fact that you were a creature, right? That was, which is why, you know, when we read the Old Testament, we, you know, we go through things like Exodus, Leviticus, and these kind of commanded feast weeks of God. Maybe that seems laborious to us, But as you look at how it was held traditionally, these were wonderful times, you know, for the people. They looked forward to these times. They weren't things that were to be dreaded. It is a day of ceasing. And it's a day of ceasing, a holiday or the Sabbath is a day of ceasing for the sake of embracing and delighting. Again, remember, leisure is not just stopping, you know, or it's not just, you know, you don't have to work. It's you take one thing off or you cease doing one thing in order to take hold of or really embrace another thing. And this is the embrace of delight. And again, we'd have to go back to the first week, that very reality of delighting, you know, having its source in God. It's an area of time that is marked off, right? You mark off a certain area of time and you're saying, we're keeping this time, right, in this special way. And it was also, religiously speaking, you know, when you refer to the cult, it was an area of space that was marked off. You know, you marked off a piece of the world and you basically said, we're having our party there, you know, whether it be temple or, you know, whatever it is. There was holy space and there was holy time. And in that taking of a piece of land and time from this world, and in one sense frivolously giving it away, you know, you're losing good real estate and you're losing good hours where you could be earning, right, or doing something, quote unquote, profitable. You take those things and you give them away in this world, but you do it in hopes of having contact with the next world. I mean, that was always the goal, to have some sort of connection and realization that there was more than this world that existed, and to take part in, if you will, for a period of time, the world to come, which whether you know it or not, I mean, that's what we are doing every Lord's Day in worship. You know, this is probably not what heaven will look like. maybe the Scottish are hoping it will look like this. But you are, I mean, notice what you're doing. You're giving away perfectly good time. I mean, how much will the advertisers today, during some game that's being played later on, how much will they pay to capture 1 minute of your time? And every week, you're just saying, I'm just going to give an hour and a half away with no, it's seemingly, worldly profit. And while I'm there, I'm going to give some of my money away that I made all week. I mean, that is craziness. You know, when you're speaking, you know, from the world's perspective, that really is, you know, it's no wonder, especially if they don't believe in any God, like that is an act of real revolution in one sense. But we're doing it because we're saying, like, I'm giving away that time because I want to have contact, in one sense, with a better place and to remember that this is not all there is and to have a foretaste of the good thing that's coming where I can cease from activity, stop trying to accomplish, no longer have to prove myself. You know, there's very little space in the world where you get to do that, and this is one of those spaces. And the reason we can do things like give our money away is because we say, like, that's okay, this is all going away anyway, right? Because we have a contact with this world to come, we realize this currency means nothing. If you've ever traveled and you come back with currency from the other country and you realize, like, I'm not going back, like, I can't afford a ticket to China, that money now becomes useless, right? In one sense, it has no value at all. So guess where all my Slovak crowns are, which is their coin in Slovak. They're all in my kids' room, you know, because they're like, oh, aren't these neat little coins? But they have zero value to me because that currency has no exchange rate here. And the same thing, you know, is what's happening as we're, you know, in giving our time and money away here. Since this has no currency there, what do I care? You know, I'll give it away for God's purposes, you know, in order to build that kingdom in the world to come. All that to say, as we speak of the Sabbath this morning, if you've been with me long enough, you know, you've probably heard some of this before. But I'm not here to lecture on the rules of the Sabbath or whether or not, you know, you should or should not go out to lunch after church, but rather to show how the Sabbath and the principles there give rise to how we can begin to understand leisure and its use in this age beyond even the Sabbath. Ultimately, so that we can become delighters, you know, those who enjoy and partake as humans made in God's image. In one sense, to reorient all of our days and to fill them with the right things by, you know, taking part in this day in order for that reorientation to take place. With that in mind, we're going to cover a few things real quick here concerning the Sabbath. And most of this we have covered before, so I don't want to belabor it. But I've also been a pastor long enough to be under no illusion that you remember everything I say just because I said it once. Sabbath is first and all done for the sake of, in order for us to enjoy. Notice the why of Exodus 20. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the seventh day, and he made it holy. Notice the command, as we've spoken about before, is grounded in something. There is a because as to why we are to keep the Sabbath. What's the because in Exodus 20? Why should we keep the Sabbath? Because, yeah, for 6 days, God created the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day, he rested. And notice, he not only rested, he blessed it and made it holy. And therefore, in Exodus 20, we're being invited into the inactivity of God. God is no longer active creatively in that way that he was on the first 6 days, and we're being invited to join him in that inactivity, to rest like he rests, but also to sanctify the day and to keep it holy like he sanctifies it and keeps it holy. And you'll notice, therefore, that the rest of God isn't based on what? Why is God resting on the seventh day? Yeah. Yep, he's not tired. Yeah, he's done. Exactly. So you'll notice he's done creating, and so he ceases. He ceases because he's finished. He doesn't cease because he's tired. And he ceases to then bless and sanctify, to enjoy the thing that he has created, to see that it has come to its telos, its end and its goal, and to embrace it for what it is. We celebrate, therefore, that on the Sabbath as well. That is why we are to cease and to rest. We are to consider the finished creation of God. That's part of what we're doing here, to truly consider, to pay attention, to delight in the things that God has made. It is a blessed day that reflects on the very on a very good project, according to the Bible. We talked about, I don't know what week it was now. I'm old. It was a week or two ago, that we're to use, you know, part of what our call and duty as Christians is gratitude. And part of what we do on this day is that very thing. Part of what we're given permission to do. God says, okay, I'm going to give you a day off so that you can join me in my rest, in my leisure, and do what I do, which is to consider the good that I have done, both in creation and in redemption, as we'll see. But here, in particular, in creation, this is what he's doing in this first command. We've talked about already the reality is creation as gift and its givenness as part of the reality of our life. Everywhere we go, we should see the giftedness of life, that there's a lot of things that we have had absolutely no part in doing in both our very being and in the world that surrounds us, and yet there we're always running in to the God who is given. You know, this world that didn't have to be, the fact that we didn't have to be, and therefore on the Lord's Day and with every other day with it as a reflection of this, we should rejoice because it could have been nothing at all. You could have been truly nothing at all. And so we, part of our ceasing on the Sabbath is to recognize that as we stop, we can stop trying to dominate the world and simply enjoy it. That part of the lie of what we do all week long is we're trying to say, you know, I'm going to make something both of myself and of this world. I'm going to fix all of these problems. And again, we are to take dominion. And yet, even in that, we realize there's only so much we can do now that the fall has taken place. And even in Adam's quest, he would have realized everything that he's touching or putting his hand to was given to him. There was nothing he's running into that was his creation first and foremost. He's making use of materials that were already there. We are priests of creation. We talked about that. Creation can find its voice through us. So we cease in order to have gratitude. So one of the things we should be doing, we cease in order to enjoy and to contemplate. We gather together this morning, for instance, with the express purpose of not accomplishing anything new today. Right, we're going to sit and we're just going to say thank you about something that was already accomplished 2,000 years ago, right? And we're going to take part in it, both in word and sacrament, and in one sense, add nothing to it. And that's good news, actually, right? That this is one place in the world where no one's expecting you to bring much to the table. And you can leave here having accomplished nothing and no one's going to be mad about it. And when we do this, though, we're fulfilling a vital role of our humanity, which will be broken, without which we will be broken in many ways. We will fulfill this role of saying thank you and to take a deep breath and remember our Creator. In the Sabbath, God really did put a close sign on the world. He said that no one works like a slave on this day. There's free time for everyone, which again, we can't go into all of it. Would it be a pretty radical concept, especially if you're an Israelite that's been living in Egypt for some time. And if there's free time, then you have free time to look around and to give thanks, free time to love things and people. And why is that so important? I mean, what happens to us all week long that makes a day like, I mean, couldn't you do that all the time? Couldn't you just give thanks always? I think there's a Bible verse about that somewhere. So what's wrong with us and the way things are presently that the Sabbath jumps in and tries to help us with? Yeah, that both the good of our vocation, which is perfectly good, and we'll talk about that in weeks to come, that those things, as good as they can be, obviously don't allow for time for us to both give thanks and enjoy other things. But not just the things that God has blessed, also our false way of using things, right? Our way of busying ourselves with all sorts of things that can be because of our anxiety or our need to prove ourselves, we will busy ourselves in ways that are unhelpful. But the bottom line is, there are things and people that a week's worth of work and our own sin will swallow up and we will forget about, right? You ever have these epiphanies, you know, these like, wow, you know, this much time has gone by and I just haven't done well with this child or this relationship, or... and you feel like, man, I got to tidy all of this up. That's good. I mean, I think a lot of times we think that that's, you know, shows how miserable we are. It's partly because we're miserable. But it's the reality of our finitude, right? You know, that we can't juggle everything and give everything the proper attention that it deserves because there's so many things pulling at us, good things, bad things, our own humanity, our own sinfulness. And yet, one thing that the Sabbath gifts us is a time to stop, take a deep breath, and notice once again where our gaps might be, right? Where our improper and imbalanced view of things might be, and to say, okay, that's right, you know, I do have a wife and children, or, you know, I do have brothers and sisters in Christ that need my love and attention, or there is a world, you know. You ever gone through a day and realized you haven't looked at anything in nature with any kind of intentionality? the you know, the rain maybe has helped us with that because it forces us to realize it's raining. You know, at least. But it gives us free time to love things and people, time to slow down from the things we rush by. You know, it does give us time to, you know, sit down for lunch or to read a book or, you know, even if you have to, take a nap, you know, because we do get tired, unlike God. But to be present and so forth. And so in the first place, Sabbath is an all done because God is done with his creation and he wants to delight in it. And therefore, he gives us permission to be all done and to delight in creation. And creation isn't just sun, moon, and stars. Creation is one another and a whole host of other things in the world that we can appreciate. But Sabbath is also an all done to being a slave. This idea of we've got to do more and got to be more. It's a world that tells us because we've got to do more and we've got to be more that we can't stop. And if you do stop, you might remember that you're not all that you're supposed to be. And so we busy ourselves, like we said, you know, last week, kind of to avoid the void. You know, that if we can just stay busy, then I don't have to think about where I'm headed, where I'm going, what that might mean, who I am and how I failed and those sorts of things. But God gives Israel a Sabbath to stop and remember. And so you'll notice the second grounding of the Sabbath in Deuteronomy 5 is different. He says that we should keep the Sabbath the first time because he worked and he rested, right? We keep the Sabbath because God delights in his creation. And, you know, therefore we should stop and delight in his creation. The second reason, though, he says, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt and your God brought you out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And so he says, we were slaves, and God redeemed us, therefore keep the Sabbath. So the second portion of the Sabbath is not just merely the creational good of the world, but the fact that we've been redeemed. And we've been redeemed, A, back to the world in one sense, but also to where this world goes, which is new creation, right? We've been redeemed back to a world, for sure, a new heavens and a new earth. And in that way, the Sabbath is a time to reflect on the fact that God has been good to us in Christ and that our redemption is a gift from him. That we can look to our past and see God's action and salvation and remember that we are safe, that everything is all right because of him. That we don't have to have anxiety about our future because that has already been solved by God, right? So how much time in your week do you spend worrying? Does anyone worry at all during the week? You know, it's not that none of us has anxieties or fears or worries. It's just more of a question of, well, how many hours do I spend with that? And a lot of times, you know, some of us wear worry as like kind of a badge of honor. Like, if I don't worry about it, who's going to? You know, there is that kind of, I'm so duty-bound that I've got to be tied up in knots while you just kind of apparently, you know, just don't think about anything and prance through the world. But the Sabbath is a time to remember, like, no, really, God cares more about your future than you do, and he's already solved every major dilemma, that whatever is going on in your life will all be consummated and well in his second coming, that there really is a heaven for us. That's a time to stop and realize that all of these things that we spend time worrying about, you know, depending on how much talk radio you listen to or how much news you watch or how many, you know, protests you go to, there's all these things that we feel that we need to solve. And those things are good. You know, this world is a real place and there are real problems. But the bottom line is we are just small little people in the midst of these huge global problems. And whatever, you know, solutions we're offering up, you know, by yelling at the wall or screaming in our car, whatever that's doing, it's probably not making a huge ripple in the major problems of the world. And the Lord's Day is a good way to remember, you know, that you're just, you know, a little fella after all. And that's okay, because God's not. And God really has your future under control. In a world where time is money and so forth, we were reminded again that we have enough and that we are enough. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this next point, but Sabbath is also the all done of all things. We talked about this before You know, so we reflect on the Sabbath, we look at creation, we also look at redemption, but we also look forward to our ultimate salvation. That Sabbath is a precursor, an entrance into what will be our eternal reality. So you'll notice that God rested on the seventh day, and then what happens? What's He do after that? What's that? Everything else, yes, yes and no. But, I mean, what does the text say? What does He do on the eighth day? You'll notice, I mean, the sun never sets on that seventh day in the text. There is no morning and evening on that day. According to the author of Hebrews, God's still resting on that day. He's still on that same Sabbath day. And according to the author of Hebrews, He's inviting us in. That when He's talking about the rest in the Old Testament, that's always where we're headed. He's saying, you guys can come join me in this seventh day where we'll spend all of our time together from here into eternity. So Hebrews chapter 4, I can't exegete the whole thing right now, but you're going to trust me. You know, the author of Hebrews says, look, if God had really given rest to our forefathers in the land of Canaan, why does He say later on that, you know, that He was angry with them, therefore He said they shall not enter His rest, but there remains a rest for the people of God. That there really is this rest held out for them. And then He says, you know, He speaks of the Sabbath in another place in this way, and then He quotes David in the Psalms. Long story short, God's still on the Sabbath day, God's still resting on the Sabbath day, and He's waiting for us to join Him there. And so the true Sabbath will be the eternal day, that final thing. And sometimes you'll hear this in the hymns, you know, the eternal day, or, you know, there's other references to it, but oh, that happy morning, you know, that, and it's this one morning. You know, there's other ones that'll say, we've been there 10,000 years. That's not nearly as good because there are no, it's all the same day, right? It's we get what we mean. So He's inviting us into His rest, that is the trajectory of our whole life, that there is a telos, there's a goal, there's a place and a time where we're headed. And that time that we're headed to is the Sabbath, God's own Sabbath. We're going to join Him there. Which I want to put before you this morning is really important for all that we're going to talk about in this series coming up, and really important to who we are as a church here at Providence. That destination, where you're headed, what your destiny is, defines almost everything. Right? Why do I say that? I mean, in business, you know, if you want to map out what you're going to do for the year, what do you have to figure out first? Yeah, well, what's the goal? I mean, what is it we want to do anyway? You don't just show up and be like, I don't know, should we start shoveling? Like, well, what's the project? I'm not sure. Just get busy. You know, and again, you've got to know what you're building or where you're headed or what the goal is in order to do or to know anything truly, which is part of the problem with our current generation, right? If postmodernism has taken its hold, if Nietzsche has won, and he has, I mean, whether you know it or not, philosophically, what Nietzsche was trying to sell us or at least warn us about and unfortunately kind of telegraphed has been purchased by us as a culture, whether we know it or not. It's not that everyone says, you know, I agree with Nietzsche, but they do by the way that they go about living their life and whether there is hope, you know, in a world to come. It poses a real problem, you know, in that we are nihilists as a culture by nature. You know, if you want to know the philosophy of nihilism, you know, the Beatles summarized it pretty well. He's a real nowhere man, sitting in a nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. He doesn't have a point of view. He knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you and me? See, this is a problem for man indeed. If we are born and we die, and there's plenty of absurdity and heartache in between, and we add to that an uncertain ending or no ending at all or no and then what is the point of this life and what should you do with it? You understand that, you know, all philosophy really is going to be born here. If there is no end, if there's no goal, if there's no telos, that is going to affect dramatically what you do with your days now if we do know this one thing. We're all headed to a graveyard, right? And if the graveyard's the last stop, well then, you know, shoot, there's a lot, as we've talked about in the weeks before, there's a lot we should be doing here. You know, eat, drink, and be merry, or whatever. Do something. Whatever is going to make you happy is what you should be doing. And does that sound like, I mean, what's interesting is this has been co-opted by even the church, you know. You know, Oprah has taught us well. You know, what is going to make you feel happy? Do that, but you should do that if this life is all that there is. If this is all, if there is no destiny that we're going for, then why have any kind of disciplines or goals, or why hold back from certain things, you know, if it's all absurdity? A world without a goal, as we'll see, and this is really where I want to get, and I probably could have gotten here a lot faster. A world without a goal is ultimately a world without a party, without anything to truly celebrate. If you don't have any hope beyond this life, then what are all these celebrations we're having anyway? We're going to get into this in the feasting topic and why feasting really is a theological reality, not just something we do because we like to, you know, have an excuse to throw a party. Now, there's perfectly good reason to have an excuse to throw a party if you're a Christian and you believe these things. If you're not, there really is nothing to celebrate. I mean, what is there to rejoice in? That's the angst of the modern age. If we're only born to die and suffer in between, then why celebrate, for instance, the day of one's birth? Why is a birthday party, you know, something to rejoice in? If you were just born to die, to maybe have a few good times, but really, you're going to suffer even in the midst of your good times. There's all kinds of heartache in between. Unless, again, there's a bigger story going on. There's more than just, you know, these bookends of birth and death. Stopping for a weekly Sabbath really is an opportunity to remember that we're going somewhere. Oh boy, I spent too much time dilly-dallying. Our mode of celebration would be what is described best by the Eagles in Hotel California. Why do people dance? Yeah, exactly. So you'll notice, if I'm saying that nihilism, this idea that there is no hope and no future, is what really holds the day, and Christianity is this idea that there is something in the future, the Lord's Sabbath, His own celebration. When we celebrate on earth, we are dancing in order to remember that even in the midst of hardship, there's a better celebration that's coming. Therefore, we can celebrate now, because even in the midst of this hardship, there is good news after it. Whereas all you have in nihilism is you can still dance, but the whole point of entertainment and feasting or anything like that is to forget where you're headed and in hopes for a brief moment to no longer understand or embrace the truth of life. And as Christians, that's why, you know, we've tried to reinforce over the years, and maybe not everyone understands like all the philosophical implications behind it, is that, you know, celebrating is ours, you know, by right. Like Christianity really does own, if you will, the right to a good time. Everyone else has taken it. And then Christianity stood back and were like, fine, you guys have it. You know, we're just going to sit back and, you know, hold up signs and protest everybody. Which nobody wants to go to that party. Not even Christians want to go to that party. But what should be the reality is while there are things to be up in arms about, even that we need to take ourselves lightly in realizing that even in the midst of the worst of affairs, we can take one day a week off and say, life is still good and precious, and there are things to celebrate and rejoice in. Why? Because there is a future and a hope, even in the midst, again, of the worst of times. The naysayer cannot party. But that is not our world, not the world of the Christian. While we can be vexed, we do not believe that the world is ultimately a vexation. And that really does have moral and theological and timekeeping implications. Thus, as Christians, we have a moral obligation to God and to the world to get this right, because we are the ones who truly get it. To sacrifice something like time, to waste it, to renounce anything like that, only makes sense if the thing is not ultimate, and that there is something else more true and good and beautiful, something more ultimately lovely that is worth, for instance, spending a bunch of money on a party for that you'll just consume all in one day and then throw the rest out the next. So notice, again, this is going to go against some people's, you know, seemingly theological bent towards things like thrift, even on a feast day. You know, two-buck chuck has its place, but, you know, not on Christmas morning, for Pete's sake. You know, now, that said, if you're, you know, dirt poor, if God has you in that place in a certain season of time, then and two-buck chuck is a luxury, then that's exactly what you should get. But if you're doing it, you know, so you can save up money and have more in the savings to hold for a future day, so that just, you know, again, we're doing it wrong. That there are times where, quote-unquote, waste, and we talked about in the first one, you have to go back to that, isn't waste, right? It really is an acknowledgement of the God of excess and the goodness that he's given. As Lewis says, joy really is the serious business of heaven. I wonder if we believe those words. But you'll notice the trajectory of the Bible, it is hard to miss unless we have been conditioned to miss it. The story starts in a garden full of delight, especially in relation to the food that is supplied. When God comes to redeem his people, he tells the people he will bring them into a land overflowing with milk and honey. And when he shows up in human flesh, the first sign he performs is to make what seems like an imprudent amount of very good wine at a party. A party in which those present have already imbibed in their fair share and will not even appreciate the goodness that he gives. His ministry is characterized by eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners, so much so that he is framed as a winebibber and a glutton. And when the story comes to a close, it closes at a party. You know, the feast of all feasts, the marriage supper of the Lamb. What about when Jesus came? What sorts of things he did, what did he do often, much to everyone's chagrin, on the Sabbath day? You'll notice one of Jesus' big mistakes, you know, Messiah-wise, was doing really good things, but just at the wrong time, right? It's like, that would have been fine on Tuesday, but you did it on the Sabbath, and so now we're really frustrated. But what did he do on the Sabbath? He healed the sick. He, you know, a man with a withered hand made whole. The blind are given sight. The hungry were fed. Sins were forgiven. You'll notice the pattern from Old Testament to New Testament. All that is wrong with the world is set right on the Sabbath. Poverty is eased. Prisoners are set free. Slaves are released. Illness is gone. Even sins are forgiven by Jesus on the Sabbath day. Is there any period of time in the future that this reminds you of, where all sicknesses will be healed and sinners will be sat down with and given food, where sins will... And again, when Christ keeps doing these things on the Sabbath, he's doing them intentionally to say, this is where the kingdom ends. These are the sorts of things that are the future of the kingdom in totality, that this is the life that I'm bringing, this true life of abundance and joy, where there's no more sorrow, no more tears, no more illness, no more sins, no more poverty. Thus, leisure, as a practice, is born on the Sabbath and gives rise to all the forms that are also born there. Well, that's a good enough place to stop. In due time, what I'm going to give a preview in case I don't get there. I'm going to get there, but in case I don't. This, you know, we talked about it some last week. Think about, you know, what leisure is and then how it's practiced. You know, the goal of leisure, this idea of contact with the world to come, time to contemplate the good and the true and the beautiful, what sorts of things do we do with our leisure time, or what other sorts of things are born out of the concept of Sabbath and leisure? We will see, and again, I'll just cut to the chase, feasting, this idea of feast days and holy days is born here, even play. The idea of true play, what does it mean to, you know, which is why, you know, when people say they take an exception because they believe in play on the Sabbath, I don't believe that's even, it may be an exception with our confession, but I don't think it's an exception. That play, A, is part of heaven, right? The children will play in the streets, and they'll even do so right over, you know, snakes' dens, which I don't encourage yet on the Sabbath. But but play is born there, and we've talked, you know, well, we'll get into that in weeks to come. Well, we'll just stop there. There are plenty of things that we'll see are born here, but that these should be intentional, things that we're intentionally engaging in, not simply because they're fun. Now, don't get me wrong. If your leisure becomes about the byproduct of leisure, you'll lose it. You should play because play is delightful. But in the delight, you're really having contact with a land of true delight, right? You know, and in one sense, the glory of play, as we'll see in the weeks to come, is what gets lost when you're truly playing? If you're truly playing, what don't you take consideration of? What time it is, right? If you ever played as a kid, you know, really played, your parents got mad when you weren't home. That's when, you know, because you just missed it. I lost track of time, right? A beautiful thing. Well, there was something else that was said. Yeah, true play, you're not thinking like, do I look good right now? Is everyone concerned? But right, you all of a sudden, you're caught up in the thing, right? Which is bigger than you, thank God, right? And for a moment, you're happy because you forget about you, right? There's a bigger, better, you know, more beautiful world. We'll start to see that all of these things, you know, feasting and play and Sabbath, have at their root things that the Bible will then say are virtuous, that are things that we need to be, you know, seeking anyhow. And I think they can help us build a manner of living that will then lend itself, again, to true godliness. And not by, you know, again, getting alone and contemplating merely our navel, but by getting together and in one sense contemplating the good.